The following is a recording of the CG Sci-Log teleconference with Economic Policy Institute on Tuesday, September 11th, 2012 at 10 a.m. Central Time. Excuse me, everyone. We now have our speakers in conference. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of the presentation, we will open the floor for questions. At that time, instruction will be given if you would like to ask a question. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. Josh Bivens. Mr. Bivens, you may begin.
Thank you. My name is Josh Bivens, and I'm the Research and Policy Director here at the Economic Policy Institute, and I'm also a co-author of The State of Working America. Before we get started, just in case somebody has not received the PowerPoint presentation that we're going to be walking through in this call, you can reach it at www.epi.org/press/swa_presentation. Again, that's epi.org/press/swa_presentation. I'm mostly just going to set the stage for the rest of the presentation and highlight some main themes and key findings, and then I will pass it off to my co-authors. And so here they are. What we think the State of Working America demonstrates clearly is that by far the biggest barrier to low and middle income families achieving decent rates of growth of wages, incomes, and wealth over the three decades before the Great Recession was the rapidly growing share of overall economic growth claimed by the already very rich. Further, this sharp rise in inequality wasn't just a sad accident. Instead, it was the totally predictable outcome of policy decisions too often intentionally redistributed income upwards. What we're going to show you today in our presentation is data showing the extent to which low and middle income families have been largely left out of overall economic gains in recent decades, the consequence of this resulting inequality, and the fingerprints of policy decisions that can largely explain these trends. We all know the most pressing economic problem right now is too high unemployment, and we at EPI are pretty dismayed at the apparent willingness of too many policymakers to tolerate it, but we're going to show that this indifference is hardly shocking. Economic policy has increasingly been captured by the already rich and influential over most of the past generation, with the result being that policy decisions have been consistently indifferent at best or outright damaging to prospects for low and middle income families. So we're going to move on to the presentation. The main findings we're going to discuss are, first, the lost decade of income growth that has already happened for most American families. Second, lost decade that is probably still in the pipeline unless much more aggressive action to lower unemployment is undertaken. Third, we're going to show the three decades before the Great Recession that were mostly characterized by rising inequality that blocked decent living standards growth for low and middle income families. And lastly, we're going to show the clear fingerprints of intentional policy decisions that drove this redistribution towards the very top. We're going to start with Elise Gould, and then she'll hand off to Heidi Shierholz, and then Larry Michel will round it out, and I'll come back and just give you a quick list of things we don't discuss in detail but are in the book and may pique your interest, and you can ask us about it either in the Q&A or contact us afterwards. And so now I'm going to move on and hand it over to Elise Gould, but before she starts, I'm going to give you the website one more time. www.epi.org/press/swa_presentation. Elise, you want to start?
Great. Thanks, Josh. I'm going to start talking about how America's broad middle class has already suffered a lost decade. The first figure in the presentation shows the income of working-age families since 1995. We focus on working-age families as opposed to all Americans because the incomes of older Americans are less based on the labor market and more on government transfers. What this figure shows is that in the late 1990s, incomes for those of the middle grew, then it failed to grow over the full business cycle, 2000-2007, and then incomes declined steadily in the Great Recession. It was a lost decade because not only did family incomes decline in the recession, but also in the full business cycle that preceded it. The next figure demonstrates the gap between productivity and hourly compensation. We include compensation here to emphasize that we aren't just looking at the gap between productivity and wages, but also other forms of compensation, like health insurance benefits and retirement. Productivity is measured as output per hour worked. You can think of it as the potential that could have been put into wages and benefits. We focus on productivity growth as a key economic benchmark. We think that the wages and incomes of low and middle income families should at least match the overall rate of productivity as it did in the 30 years after World War II. What we see here instead is that workers were becoming more productive, but their wages weren't reflecting their increased productivity. You can clearly see the growing gap between productivity and compensation for workers at the middle, the median worker. Even compensation for college graduates has not kept up with productivity. In fact, for all three groups shown, we've seen flat growth, lagging gains in productivity. Now I'm going to talk about the threat of another lost decade. The first graph in that section shows the unemployment rate and projections of the unemployment rate from the Congressional Budget Office. Unfortunately, what's shown here is that the pain is not nearly over. The lost decade of the 2000s is likely to be followed by another lost decade. The unemployment rate is expected to stay above 8% well into 2014 and is not projected to hit pre-recessionary levels for many years to come. And sadly, every year, the Congressional Budget Office moves the job recovery further out into the future. The next slide, the predictions shown here are based on the historical relationship between the income growth of middle-income families and the unemployment rate. Given the continued slack in the labor market for the next several years, as shown in the previous slide, family incomes are expected to stay below the 2000 level into the future, projected there by two different sources. Now I'm going to talk about longer trends. So rising inequality blocked wage and income growth for most of the last generation of Americans. I'm going to talk about the trends in the next few slides here. The next slide shows the cumulative change in real annual household income for selected income groups. While the middle income fifth, the incomes of middle income Americans, grew only 19.2% from 1979 to 2007, the top 1% grew over 240%. Wages make up the largest component of incomes for most Americans. In the next slide, we turn to the cumulative changes in wages by wage groups. Wages for the top 1% grew over 130% from 1979 to 2010. Wages for the bottom 90% of Americans, that is the 90% of Americans below the top 10%, grew only 15.2% between 1979 and 2010. Even those with wages between the 90th and the 99th percentile grew much slower than those in the top 1%. This demonstrates the growing concentration of labor incomes. Still, the growth in wages at the top was much slower than overall income. So what makes up the difference? Here we turn to the growth in capital income. This next figure shows the cumulative growth in capital income or returns to assets, owning physical and financial capital. This income comes in the form of interest payments, dividends, realized capital gains, and other business income. Essentially, capital incomes are returns to holding wealth, whereas labor incomes are the returns to work. Here we see that the cumulative change in capital income is negative for the middle on down, and over 300% for the top 1%, faster than the growth of wages at the top. So I've already mentioned the unequal growth or concentration of labor and capital income. The third component of rising income inequality is a shift in the share of overall income from labor to capital income, as shown on the next slide. This growth in the share of income from capital exacerbates income inequality. Now Heidi Shierholz will discuss the consequences of rising inequality.
Yes. Hello, everyone. This is Heidi. And so we've documented increasing inequality, and so I'll go over more what that really means on the ground. And this first chart, just to make sure everyone's on the same page, I'm looking at that pie chart. It shows the share of total household income growth that accrued to various parts of the income distribution. And if you look at the upper left part of this pie, what it shows is that rising inequality has meant that the overall growth in the economy from 79 to 2007 accrued to a very small sliver of households. The figure shows that the top 1%, that 38% of the total wealth, the total income growth over this period accrued to the top 1%. And this is actually more than the entire bottom 90% got, and let me show you how you see that. If you look at the very top of the pie, you'll see that the bottom fifth got less than 1% of the total growth over this period, and if you sort of sweep down, adding up to the right through the 90th percentile, you'll see that the entire bottom 90% got just 36.7% of the growth. So most of the growth went to the very top sliver. And the next slide, turn to the next slide now. To me, this is a real sort of punch in the gut slide. I think it's one of the key things that we point out in this book, because it answers this question, okay, why do we care if the top is doing really well? How does that impact most people? This slide shows it. What it shows is how middle-income people could have done if we hadn't seen the increase in inequality over this period. And let me walk you through it. The bottom part of this slide shows actually what middle income was, what the average income of the middle fifth was by 2007. It was around $70,000. The top part of that little area shows how the middle fifth could have done if the top hadn't claimed such a big share of the total growth over this period. In other words, if inequality hadn't increased, if the middle had simply seen the same growth that everyone saw, that the average got, the middle fifth would have seen incomes in 2007 of around $89,000. So instead of $70,000, they would have had $89,000. So that's the sort of $19,000 inequality tax, the difference between what they have and what they could have had if we hadn't seen this big increase in inequality over this period. The next slide shows how increasing income does translate into, increasing income inequality translates into increasing wealth inequality. This shows how much of the total increase in wealth from 1983 to 2010 accrued to various parts of the wealth distribution. The two large bars on the right are the wealth going to the top 5%. The top 5% claims nearly three-quarters of the total increase in wealth over this period. The negative first three bars that actually go down, those are the wealth accrual to the bottom 60%. The people at the bottom of the income distribution never had that much wealth, but they actually saw a decline over those 27 years. The next slide is what I think is kind of the punch in the gut slide for what all this means for the bottom of the income the bottom of the income distribution. It shows the results of a simple exercise that uses the relationship between the change in economic growth and the poverty rate. So the dark blue line is the actual poverty rate, and the light blue line is the predicted poverty rate based on the relationship between per capita GDP growth and poverty prior to 1973. So up through the early 1970s, as per capita GDP grew, poverty decreased in lockstep, as you might imagine. But after that, the relationship broke. Per capita GDP kept growing, but poverty rates leveled off. Is this what we see here? Is this right in line with everything else we've shown so far, that growth since the 1970s did not reach the bottom of the income distribution? And this shows that if it had, we very likely would have seen continued strong reductions in poverty. And finally, the next slide, I just want to make the point that sort of answers the question, does it have to be this way? Is this just the inevitable, is this just the nature of things? This next slide shows that no, we have before seen periods of strong and much more broadly shared growth. So the light blue bars show the average annual growth at income growth at various portions of the income distribution between 1947 and 1979. And you can see growth was both strong over this period and very broadly shared. You actually see that the bottom 95% got slightly faster growth than the top 5%. So inequality was decreasing over this period ever so slightly, but it definitely wasn't increasing. And then you see the next period, 79 to 2007, which is what everything else we have shown, that shows instead of that picket fence, we show that stair step where more of the growth is going to the higher up the income distribution. And I will now turn this over to Larry, who will show how the fingerprints of policy decisions were all over this shift that blocked income growth for low and middle income people.
Thank you, Heidi. As the book shows, there was substantial income growth over the last 30 years, as there will be over the next 30, and it was only the growth of inequality that prevented the vast majority from having substantial growth in living standards. And we believe the income inequality growth was due to policy. And what we mean by policy is policy actions which hurt or failed middle-class workers, as well as failures to act on behalf of middle class workers. We think that the chart on slide 21, which shows the growth of productivity and the growth of real hourly wages and benefits compensation for typical worker, documents one of the key dynamics, which is that in the early post-war period up through the 1970s, when workers' productivity, their output of goods and services per hour worked, improved, their hourly compensation was correspondingly improved. However, in the last 30 years or so, productivity continued to grow substantially, but the hourly wages and benefits of a typical worker did not. The actual number for that is that productivity grew from 1973 to 2011 by 80%, but that the hourly compensation of the median worker grew by 11%. 80% productivity growth, 11% real hourly median compensation. Now, what generated that was this divergence is primarily two things. One is the shift of income from income from work to income from holding financial assets, and secondly, the growing inequality of wage and benefit income, or in short, wage inequality. And we believe that the way to understand both of those is to focus on what we call the three key wage gaps, rather than to treat it as one unified phenomena. We focus on what happened between the, and we're talking primarily about the labor market, the wage inequality, what happened between the very top and everybody else. Then another key gap is what the difference between wages at the bottom versus the middle. And the third key wage gap is the gap between those in high wages, roughly the 90th, 95th percentile wage, and those in the middle. And they each have different causes and different happen at different times. But the point, the main overall point we want to make is that they all can be explained relatively easily by focusing on a few key areas where policy could have made, did make a substantial difference. And first we turn to what explains the growth of wages at the very top. Why did wages grow for the top 1% so much faster than everybody else? As Heidi said, up 131% for the top 1%, while the vast middle grew, had wage growth of just 15%. We show two charts, starting on page 24. The first is showing that the marginal income tax rate from the federal income taxes was substantially changed so that taxes on the very high end of earnings substantially declined. This had two effects. One, the more well-known one, which is that whatever increase of inequality you get from market incomes got exacerbated by the government in terms of shifting the distribution of the tax burden. But we also point to the fact that when there were very high tax rates on high-income earners, there was not the incentive for a CEO to try to have such exorbitant pay as they now have, so that these tax changes actually help fuel the growth of CEO pay. And in the next chart, we document, based on a study of tax returns, how much of the growth of the top 1% of households' incomes came from households headed by someone that was an executive or someone that was in the financial sector. And the chart shows that the top 1%, the share of income going to the top 1% more than doubled from 1979 to 2005, which was the end year for this study. And about 60% of this increase can be attributed solely to executives and the financial sector. The next chart shows analysis we've done of the growth of CEO pay in large firms relative to that of the typical worker in their industries. And I think it's well known, but worth repeating, that these days CEOs make, you know, over 200, maybe 230 times that of a typical worker, and just 30 years ago they used to make just 20 times as much, from 20 times as much to more than 200 times as much. So it's very easy to explain what why the top pulled away. Now we're going to look at what happened between the middle and the bottom. And the growth of wages in the bottom fell relative to the middle, basically only in the 1980s and primarily for women. And that should give you a clue that one of the major causes was the chart on page 28, which was the failure to raise the minimum wage during the 1980s to keep up with inflation and to keep up with average wages. And the minimum wage in this chart is represented relative to the average wage. And it shows that in the late 1960s, the minimum wage represented, it was a labor standard representing 50% of the average wage. And now, even though there were some increases in the mid-2000s, it only represents 37% of the average wage. In absolute terms, the minimum wage is now 12%, inflation-adjusted, lower than 1967, even though productivity is up over 100% since that time. We document in the book that this erosion of the minimum wage relative to the middle can explain 57% of the overall growth in the wage gap between the middle and the bottom, and about two-thirds of the wage gap for women between the middle wage women and the bottom wage woman. So the minimum wage alone can basically explain a lot of the wage inequality at the bottom. The other part can be explained by unemployment, which is the next chart, which shows how does a lower unemployment rate, a 1 percentage point lower unemployment rate, affect the wage growth for each wage decile. And we separate that for men and women. But the bigger point here is that lower unemployment benefits lower wage workers more than middle wage workers, and middle wage workers more than high wage workers. It also tends to have a bigger effect, benefit for men than for women. So that if you want to explain the erosion of the wages at the bottom relative to the middle, the minimum wage and unemployment alone can basically explain that. And that higher unemployment than necessary, we can talk about what policies could have led to lower unemployment, but we believe that also led to substantial wage erosion for middle-wage men as well as middle-wage women. Last, the continuing growth of the wage gap between a median worker and workers at the top, that has been growing from 1979 through 2011, and it really comes from a range of policies that have undercut the ability of middle-wage workers to see their wages rise with productivity, to have good quality jobs. We document a number of these in the book. I'm only going to talk about two. The first is globalization, which is increasingly becoming widely known, that the growth of import competition from less developed countries, which this chart on page 31 shows, really picked up in the 1990s and grew further in the 2000s, alone can help explain a lot of the growth of wage inequality. We update a model that Paul Krugman developed in the mid-1990s, where he showed that at that time he didn't think that trade had much effect on wage inequality. By now, when you update that model, it would show that a third of the increase of the wage gap between the most educated workers and those with less education, around a third of that wage gap can be explained by trade. And in the post-1995 period, the education wage gap can almost fully be explained by the growth of imports from less developed countries. Last, we'll point to the erosion of union coverage, which was primarily hit men and middle-wage men, blue-collar men. When the unionization rate and the collective bargaining coverage eroded, it did three things. It reduced the number of middle-wage workers who benefited from having a union and therefore having better wages and benefits. Two, it shrunk the share of the workforce covered by collective bargaining, and that sector has much less wage inequality within it than in the non-union sector. And the third impact, perhaps the largest impact, is the fact that collective bargaining in occupations and industries where density of collective bargaining is high, the non-union workers enjoy better wages and benefits that are provided by the employers. A study released last year showed that around a third of the wage inequality for men can be explained by the erosion of collective bargaining, and around 20% of the wage inequality for women. Other matters, to us, this is all part of an erosion of labor standards, minimum wage, unions, globalization, privatization, deregulation of particular industries that contributed to making it harder for middle-class workers to earn a decent wage. Now for Josh to wrap it up.
Yes, I would like to thank everyone for joining the call. We'd urge you to browse the book and the website and read the overview chapter. That we really try to encapsulate a lot of our findings in a way that hopefully can communicate to a lot of people. And then just to run over a couple topics that we have not delved into in detail right here but might pique your interest, I just want to give a list of those. First one, we have evidence on how there's very little evidence that there is any skills gap or why inequality is not about the lagging education of America's workers. You know, to be clear, an increased effort to provide a universally excellent education to all Americans is a great goal, but as a diagnosis about why inequality rose, or as a diagnosis about why there's disappointing living standards growth at the low and the middle, that the skills gap hypothesis just really does not have any explanatory power. We show evidence on deep poverty, which the share of families living below half the official poverty threshold actually reached its highest rate on record in 2010, and we'll have more evidence on what happened to poverty in 2011 tomorrow when the Census Bureau releases information on income and poverty. We have a whole chapter on economic mobility that shows that the U.S. today is not a mobile society relative to either its own history or to its international peers. We have a wealth chapter that documents, besides just the stunning fall in wealth associated with the bursting housing bubble for middle wealth families, you know, there has been no democratization of the stock market. You still have the vast, vast majority of all stocks held by a pretty narrow slice. We have evidence that Social Security and Medicare have actually contributed much more to growth in the middle part of the income distribution than wages and salaries have over pretty much the past generation, 1979 to 2007. And then we also have evidence, and this is not one of the bullet points, but I realize it's an important one we should talk about, that the degree to which middle-income families have both vastly increased the amount of hours they put into the paid labor market and their ability to increase their educational credentials over those past 30 years have been substantial and yet have not paid off in the sort of living standards growth you'd expect from that. So I'd urge you to browse our material and ask any questions that pique your interest either right now, or you can contact us later and we'd be happy to talk to you about it. So I think we're going to throw it up into questions now.
Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the 1 key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order they are received. Again, that is star 1 if you would like to ask a question. Our first question comes from Mark Gruenberg with the Press Associates Union.
Press Associates Union News. Question for Larry. Let's go back to the policies and let's pin these down. Who is responsible for these policies, and not only which blocks of people or lobbyists or whatever you want to call them, but also which blocks of politicians in both parties were responsible for imposing these policies that led to income inequality and income inequality. And a second question, in chapter two, you forecast that there's going to be another decade, it's going to be at least another decade before wages reclaim their 2000 peak. And I'm not sure whether I'm reading it as another decade or another 20 years. How about unemployment? How long will it take to get back to that 4% that we had the day George W. Bush took office before everything collapsed?
Well, this is Larry. Thanks for the question. We're economists, not political scientists. I would refer you to the political history, I think, well done by Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson in the winner-take-all politics, which seems very sound to me. But we believe that the policies were implemented were those which favored those at the very top, and presumably were pushed by those at the very top, and that I think that this happened. Some of the policies were evident when both parties were in power, so it's not a particular party, but it is a particular economic way of thinking that we think has failed the broad middle class. And the specific policies are ones we've talked about. It's failure to maintain the economy at as low unemployment as possible, to maintain the minimum wage at a reasonable level, to maintain that workers can pursue collective bargaining if they so choose, to manage globalization in a way that benefits workers, that protects basically the economic security and living standards of workers overall. And I'll let Josh talk about the projection of the next decade of on income growth.
Right.
Yeah, so that projection was based on two things. It was based on sort of macroeconomic forecasters predicting or forecasting what unemployment was going to do over the next 7 or 8 years. We looked at a couple forecasts. Congressional Budget Office and Moody's were the two we went with. And then basically looked at the historical relationship between unemployment and rates of growth of family income for the middle fifth of families, kind of the heart of the middle class. And if you take, you know, if the CBO and Moody's are generally right about what's going to happen to unemployment over the next 7 or 8 years, which is, you know, a pretty slow decline and not reaching anything like pre-recession levels until closer to 2017, 2018, we think there's going to essentially be, from 2000 to almost 2020, is going to be pretty safe to say there'll be no income growth for middle-income families unless those unemployment projections turn out to be wrong, unless we do something radically different to really yank down the unemployment rate. I think in terms of when are we going to see 4% unemployment again, I'm afraid to say that's just not on the horizon at all. I mean, one of the things we talk about in the book is when we talk about the effect of excessive unemployment on wage growth, you know, there's sort of two issues there. One is, is the Federal Reserve's target unemployment rate, which people call the natural rate or the NIRU, is that too conservative? Is that too high and higher than it needs to be to keep inflation in check? And we think it generally is. And then there's the issue of, do they even hit their own target? And so I think right now their target rate is still too high. I mean, I think the latest ones I've seen, it's their target rate is above 5.5% if you infer it from what they're saying. And, of course, they're missing it by a lot right now because the economy is in such crisis. So, you know, the tight labor markets of the late 1990s, I think we could get them back. I think there's nothing in and of itself that said 4% unemployment was not sustainable. I think we have sadly made the political decision that we're just not going to do it.
Thank you.
Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Tammy Luby with CNN Money.
Hi, the previous caller asked one of my questions. The other one, I just wanted to double check. These figures are all adjusted for inflation, of course, right?
Yes,
you got it.
Okay, that's what I thought. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Our next question comes from Ronald Brownstein with National Journal.
Hi, Larry. When you listed your policies that you thought would help, you didn't say anything about moving more people into and through college. To what extent do you think that would be a significant factor in reversing some of these trends, or would it simply just lower the returns for a college degree?
Thanks, Ron, for the question. You know, we, as Josh noted, we believe providing more education and training for workers is essential for providing greater opportunity, for cementing upward mobility, social mobility. I don't think that the failure to increase the share of workers going to college is what has caused this inequality or what has bedeviled the middle class. We have over the last, since 1973, increased the share of people going to college from around 12% to 33%. And over the last 10 years, wages for the bottom 70% of college graduates has fallen. The wages of young people with a college degree in their mid-20s has fallen every year since the year 2000. And the wage gap between those with a college degree and not has grown very little over the last 15 years. These are all evidence that there is not some huge excess demand for college graduates. The other one, which we can't document with data, is all around you, which is college graduates working for free as interns.
Right.
Because people working for free are not in great demand.
So let me just follow up, Larry. Just to be clear then, not looking backward at the extent to which it has contributed or not contributed to the problem, but looking forward to the extent it is part of the solution, to what extent would, you know, certainly a high priority for almost, you know, many Democrats who look at this problem saying, you know, get more people into and through college, to what extent do you see that as part of the solution going forward?
I think that it's a solution from the point of view of an individual person or a family. Is not necessarily a solution for the working class as a whole. And so I think it is good to provide people those avenues for upward mobility, but I do believe that if we had 40% of people with a college degree or more now rather than 33%, we would have less inequality, but we would also have substantially lower wages for those people with a college degree. And I don't think that is exactly what everyone has in mind when they want to fix the problem of income inequality.
Okay.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Neil Monroe with the Daily Caller.
So the thing that seems to jump out is there seems to be a lot of unskilled labor at the lower end. And so in that sense, would it make sense to change immigration policy to actually reduce the importation of low-skilled labor?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure what you mean by low-skilled labor. We track the and frequently people mean those people who have not completed a high school degree or a GED, and we actually do show that that's fallen from roughly 30% of the workforce in 1973 to around, I don't know, 6 or 7% now. So there's actually a vast decrease in the share of workers who you could in any way call unskilled. There are in the group that remains of people without a high school degree, half of them are immigrants. And so it would be less if we had fewer immigrants. We don't believe that immigration has been one of the major factors driving up wage inequality at the bottom. I do think that some of the policies that guest worker policies, temporary worker policies, are part of what is being used to undercut labor standards. And I think that it would be better for all workers if we brought people out of the shadows and if we had a better regulated temporary worker programs which did not undercut labor standards.
Okay, but if it undercuts the bargaining power, increases the unemployment, drives down wages, as your report describes, to have high unemployment drive down wages, and if there's a surplus of unskilled labor at the very bottom, even if it's a shrinking percentage of the population, that still extends the low end of the bell curve in your inequality curve to some extent and might have a disproportionate impact. So in that case, as you just said, it would make a difference. So would you recommend cut?
We should talk more offline later, but we believe that there's a vast surplus of workers at every educational level. During this recession, the unemployment rate doubled for those with a college degree, with those with an advanced degree, with those with an associate college degree, as well as for those without any degree, without even a high school degree. So we think that the labor surplus overall is what is the problem, rather than the particular labor surplus at the bottom. But if we want to pursue this more, be glad to talk to you on the phone later.
That would be good. Thank you very much.
As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch tone phone now. We are currently holding for questions. There are no questions at this time.
Just want to thank everyone again for joining the call and tell you to definitely contact our media department if you'd like to talk to any of the co-authors about anything else that pops up. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's teleconference. You may now disconnect.